Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
Just a few days ago, the press and the pundits had declared the campaign dead. And then came South Carolina. They had something to say about it. And we're told, well, when you got to Super Tuesday, it'd be over. Well, it may be over for the other guy.
Well, that was former Vice President Joe Biden last night in Los Angeles, feeling the wind in his sails after a commanding set of victories in Super Tuesday voting yesterday. But Biden has more than jumped the gun in saying it's over for, quote, the other guy. Biden was in L.A., as we noted, but it was Senator Bernie Sanders who carried California. Sanders also has the most comprehensive field organization of any candidate in the race. He's got money and momentum from those early primary wins, and Senator Sanders has the passion of a coalition of supporters who rallied with him last night in Vermont.
We're going to beat Trump because this will become a contrast in ideas. One of us in this race led the opposition to the war in Iraq. You're looking at him. Another candidate voted for the war in Iraq.
So two very different messages there for America, even as Democrats try to focus on their ultimate goal, which is beating President Trump in November. So what happens next? This hour on Point, Biden, Sanders, and the path forward for Democrats after Super Tuesday. Now, we're going to start today in North Carolina, which can be seen as maybe one of the swingiest of swing states come November. It's got a little bit of everything. It's got college-educated progressives. It's got a very large suburban population. It has significant numbers of African-American and Hispanic voters. So what happened in North Carolina last night, and what does it tell us about the path forward for Democrats come November? So joining us now from Raleigh is Dawn Baumgartner-Vaughn. She's government and politics reporter at the News and Observer. Dawn, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So it's great to hear from North Carolina here. It's a key state for any candidate come November. What happened in the Democratic primary there?
Well, you know, we had a whole bunch of early voters. I think it was something like 800,000. But those that waited till actual primary day, I think obviously impacted what the results were. And we really didn't know until the results came in if it would be Biden versus Bernie or not, or even if Bloomberg, who spent a lot of money here, would make more of a showing. But turns out it went Biden, same as South Carolina.
Right. And Biden by a fairly commanding margin, right? Here I'm seeing 43% to Bernie Sanders, 24%.
Yeah, he even carried some, you know, of the much more progressive counties like Durham, who's the co-chair of, well, the Bernie's campaign is the Durham Mayor Pro Tem and Chapel Hill, who Bernie rallied at a few months ago, and Biden carried those, not Sanders. So those were some surprises. I covered Biden coming to a small private HBCU in Raleigh this past Saturday, and there wasn't a huge crowd there, but, you know, rally crowds doesn't always determine who, you know, how people end up voting.
Mm. So how the vote, the primary vote came down in North Carolina? What does that tell you about what you think North Carolinian Democrats are looking for?
You know, it's hard to say. This is a state that went for Obama and it also went for Trump. And you don't know, because in North Carolina, you know, unaffiliated voters can vote in the primary. Was it all Democrats? Was it people that lean Democrat? As far as how they voted, I don't think we should count out the importance of the African-American vote and supporters there for Biden. And that turnout, I think, helped him some. So, yeah, I mean, we thought probably Biden, but I didn't think that it would be so much Biden over Sanders, really.
That's so interesting. And just so if I heard you correctly, Dawn, did Biden not have as much of a field presence in North Carolina as Sanders did?
No,
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I know the Warren, and Warren had a lot of local endorsements, and there was a big enthusiasm for her rally here, you know, a couple months ago, and long lines and crowds and everything. But again, you know, that's not always an indicator of votes. And I know the Warren campaign people, the Bloomberg campaign people were everywhere. I know the Sanders campaign, you know, by name and their cell numbers. And with Biden, that's just not there. I didn't know the names of the press people. You know, I've covered him twice when he came through, and it wasn't the same kind of field presence that the other campaigns had. But you know, I guess that's not what was needed for when people voted yesterday.
Isn't that interesting, right? Because the conventional wisdom thus far, actually in the campaign, has been that you know, the ground game really matters, that direct outreach to voters, that the knocking on doors, et cetera. But from what you're saying, that mm-hmm. it did not have an impact at all in terms of how North Carolina voted yesterday.
You know, I think if people weren't looking at the South Carolina primary and thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, it looks like Biden could get this if they think Biden is the best person to defeat Trump, and then they went for him, I think that may have counted more than if we went before, you know, South Carolina. So I think that's a pretty significant factor there. But it was surprising, I mean, considering how, you know, Biden was vice president and that he didn't have the people on the ground that the other campaigns have.
Okay. Now, Dawn, before I let you go, I just want to see if you can help us understand a little bit also about the Senate side of things, right? Because there was mm-hmm. an interesting primary in the on the Democratic side for nominations for United States Senate, Cal Cunningham, right, winning on the Democratic side. That's going to be a tight race in November. Tell us about that.
It will. And Erica Smith had a, you know, strong support, but didn't end up pulling it off on the end in the primary. And Erica Smith is an African-American woman. Cal Cunningham is a white man. And Cunningham got, you know, a lot more money than she did. And money doesn't always determine the outcome of a race, but, it, you know, sometimes it really does. And so he, you know, when people ended up voting, they went with Cunningham. And I think the Republicans probably would have preferred Smith if they thought Tillis had a better chance of defeating her than Cunningham. But there's going to be a lot more money to spend. And I mean, it's going to be pretty crazy, I think, with the number of, you know, it's dueling press releases daily, and just how blanket coverage everything we're going to have with that race the rest of this year, because, you know, Tillis doesn't have a whole lot of support in the party that he initially did. I covered Trump this past fall, and when Tillis came out on stage, there were some scattered boos in the crowd. But I think now that, you know, it's him, they're going to rally around him, and the Democrats will rally around Cunningham. So it'll really just come to voter turnout, I think.
A very competitive race for Senate there in New Hampshire. I mean, if you're Republican, mm-hmm. Tom Tillis, is that what you expected to have? I mean, North Carolina, sorry, not New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. there was someone that, you know, kind of potentially he was going to primary him more than, you know, the people that did. And that candidate dropped out. And then after that, it was pretty much, you know, this is Tillis and everyone will rally around him. And Tillis has really doubled down on his Trump support. He came through, you know, with candidate filing. And you know, I said, are you, you know, a definite, you know, no on impeachment and everything? And he's really just hitched his wagon to Trump. And he thinks that's what's going to help win it for him.
All right. Well, Dawn Baumgartner Vaughn, government and politics reporter at the News and Observer, speaking to us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you so much, Dawn.
Thank you.
Okay, we are talking about the path forward for Democrats following last night's Super Tuesday voting. And if you're a Democratic voter, we want to hear from you. What do you make of the fact that it's largely a two-man race now between Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders? If you're a Republican, what do you think about what happened in Super Tuesday? How things quickly change, because we've got news right now that Mike Bloomberg has dropped out of the race and he is endorsing former Vice President Joe Biden. We'll talk more about that in a second. But joining us now from Washington is Matt Bennett. He's co-founder of Third Way, a Washington think tank that promotes center-left policy ideas, worked on both Bill Clinton's presidential campaigns, and served as deputy assistant to the president for intergovernmental affairs in the Clinton White House. Matt Bennett, welcome to you.
Hi, Magna.
And joining us also from Washington is Larry Cohen. He's board chair for Our Revolution, a progressive political action organization that spun out of Senator Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. He was also senior advisor to the Sanders presidential campaign in the last election cycle as well. Larry Cohen, welcome to you.
Pleasure.
So first of all, Larry, let me hear from you. The headlines from last night are all screaming about those nine states that Joe Biden won. What's the path forward for Senator Sanders now?
Path forward is building off our base, which mostly performed the way I expected it to. The obvious difference was candidates dropping out and coalescing to some extent around Vice President Biden. But the big win in California, I think, is very indicative of where we're headed, a movement largely led by youth that's multicultural, that to me is very exciting to work with and be around.
So exciting to work with and be around, but do you feel that the senator still has the momentum that he had after Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada?
Well, not the same momentum, to be fair, to Vice President Biden, but I think that we have a very strong campaign, huge base, our revolution, many other groups in the Midwest. The Midwest is going to be where Trump gets beaten in November. And I think that really key to take away from all of this is how do these two wings of the party work together rather than one against each other? And my biggest feeling of remorse about the last 4 days is this sense that somehow it's anti-Bernie. Anti-Bernie will be a Trump victory, no question about it. So the vice president better pivot. I heard your opening soundbite and talk about how we bring the party together, how we talk about a real change in healthcare, how we talk about a real campaign on climate, how we talk about, as Bernie said in the soundbite you played, an end to the endless wars that Biden has voted for time and time again. So we need real change, not only to beat Trump, but because the millions of voters, particularly young voters, are demanding a different United States, that we join the democracies of the world and not hang back with the democracies of World War II.
So, Matt Bennett, I promise I'll give you a chance to have your say here in just a second, but the clock is intervening, so we'll take a quick break. We are talking about the path forward now for Democrats following Super Tuesday's voting. 14 states had their say, and it's essentially a two-man race now. A little later in the hour, we'll talk about the impact that Elizabeth Warren could still have on this race, so we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about what happens next after Super Tuesday's primary voting yesterday. It's essentially a two-person race now. On the Democratic side of things, between former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders, because as we just mentioned today, Mike Bloomberg has dropped out of the race. So let's listen to a little bit more about what Senator Sanders said last night in his home state in Vermont. Here's him talking about the coalition that he says he is building to defeat President Trump in November.
What we need is a new politics that brings working class people into our political movement, which brings young people into our political movement, and which in November will create the highest voter turnout in American political history.
Senator Bernie Sanders in Vermont last night, and here is former Vice President Joe Biden in California talking about unity.
Folks,
Winning means uniting America, not sowing seeds of division and anger and hate. We got to beat Donald Trump, and we will, but we can't become like him. We can't have a never-ending war between the parties. We need a president who can fight, but make no mistake about it, I can fight. But look, we need as badly, someone who can heal.
Former Vice President Joe Biden in Los Angeles. So Matt Bennett, you heard Larry Cohen before the break saying that he doesn't see Biden being a unifying figure, and yet Biden's talking about it right there. Is his talk translating into actual unity emerging amongst Democrats?
Well, not yet. We're in the midst of a very divisive primary, and divisive primaries push people apart temporarily. The hope, of course, is that we can come back together as a party by the time we have a nominee in the summer, and I think we will. But I thought what Larry said was interesting. On the one hand, he said that Bernie Sanders is actually the uniter here, but then he quoted from Sanders' speech last night, which was a very harsh attack on Joe Biden. I don't blame him for that. Elections are about contrast, and this is going to be a very tough fight down to the end. So I think it's clear that both sides are going to have to articulate their case and their case why the other guy is the wrong person to nominate. But I think it's a little much to argue that Bernie Sanders is the unifier here and that Joe Biden is the divider.
Larry, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think it is, as Matt said, incumbent on both of them to talk about how we synthesize what this party is. If we make it a win-lose between, you know, progressives, between young voters, between working class voters and traditional, more moderate and slightly older Democrats, and continue with that into the convention, we're not going to beat Donald Trump. So I think, again, for me, it's not just about beating Donald Trump. I have a life of fighting for change in this country. But I think the key takeaway for me is, and it's fair to say, Matt, that both of them, particularly now that it's down to the two of them, and I have a huge respect for Senator Warren, I don't want to, you know, omit her, but that they talk more about how they will blend these ideas together. And that means to me that there has to be a synthesis and a power sharing approach, not what we saw in 2016.
Okay, so two things there. First of all, Larry, let me just keep going with you. You said for you, it's not just about beating Donald Trump, but what would you say to all the Democratic voters out there who say, actually, for them, that's exactly what this is about?
So I don't think you beat something, even I would call him a monster president, frankly, with nothing. I think you have to have a clear vision for change. I think part of the reason Secretary Clinton, despite her huge win in the popular vote, which I applaud, it didn't succeed in the Midwest and in Pennsylvania, was it wasn't clear that she was a force for change. It seemed like continuity with the Obama years. People are crying out, working class people, black, brown, and white, for real change. And we have to answer that call and not just view this in this moment as some kind of political foot race. Of course, it is that, but I would challenge us all to go beyond that and talk about the vision for change in this country that includes beating Trump, but way beyond it.
Okay, so Matt, is the former vice president, does he have that vision for exactly the kind of change that has so inspired so many of Senator Sanders' supporters?
I hope so. I think that we are going to see some fall off. It's been pretty clear. Senator Sanders' supporters have made themselves very clear about that, that if we don't nominate Sanders, they're walking away. I hope they change their mind in the face of an election that could be the most important in the modern history of the United States. We could have our republic at stake here because Trump is such a catastrophic president, as I know Larry agrees. So I really do hope that by the time we come out of our convention in Milwaukee, we're as unified as we can be going into the fall. But I don't know that Joe Biden is going to be able to blend, as Larry puts it, some of the big ideas that Senator Sanders is offering. Because, look, what he is offering is a revolution. And that isn't what Joe Biden wants to do. He doesn't want to double the size of the federal government, spend $60 trillion additional new dollars. That's just a fundamental difference between the two of them. and it may be a bridge too far.
Okay, so this is where we really need to dig in then with both of you, because I think this has been the question that has been dogging Democrats for this entire election cycle thus far, and it has come into extremely sharp relief. If what we have is fundamentally two competing, profoundly different visions for what should be possible in November 2020. I mean, Larry, you just heard that Matt says he's not sure that there can be the kind of blending that needs to happen. And I'll say, out of fairness, I'm not sure I've heard Senator Sanders say from his point of view that there's any kind of blending that could or should happen.
Yeah, again, as I said, I think that's a fair comment. Your comment, I would say to Matt, and again, he has a lifetime of public service, which I respect, that kind of comment about $60 trillion, let's just take health care. Everybody knows that two-thirds of our health care spending is the government now. Yet Biden, Buttigieg, couldn't help but count that money again. Everybody knows that the average American family spends $10,000 a year on health care, and that the Medicare for All, the Jayapal bill, which has a lot more detail in it, would cut that by two-thirds, that cost. So everybody knows what the real numbers are, but we get numbers like that. In that convention in Milwaukee, where I'll be quite actively involved on the Rules Committee and talking to the Bernie supporters, as I did in 2016, that no, we're not leaving. No, we're staying. No, this is our country. As Matt said, we will defeat Trump, whatever that takes. But at the same time, we will not put up with that kind of rhetoric, which grossly distorts an issue like Medicare for All or the climate initiative that everybody knows is going to be incredibly expensive. What's the alternative? We're going to fund FEMA to spend the same money, the disaster relief that we could have spent to prevent the climate crisis. We're not going to take on fossil fuels. We're not going to say that, yes, we're going to put $1 trillion a year into renewable energy that, by the way, will pay us back. So we've got to look for the places where, and I would say healthcare and climate are two of them, foreign affairs is another, and the endless wars, where we can come together. And yes, it's true, as Matt said, these campaigns do not bring that out. But at some point here, we have to look to June, July, and that's where we need to be. Synthesis, not what we had in 2016. We need real respect for these ideas that have tens of millions of people behind them.
Okay, so Larry, let me just follow up with one thing. So would you like to see that synthesis beforehand? Or I'm trying to figure out what you're saying here. Are you wondering about whether that synthesis is possible afterwards if, everything's a big if still, if Senator Sanders does not become the nominee?
I think we need more of that synthesis now. And I'm not saying it's just Joe Biden, by the way. But these last debates I thought were horrible in that regard. I think we need more of it now, and we need more of a sense from people who are active in the campaigns that that is what our goal is. It's power sharing. It's not a foot race where one wins, the other loses. That's what happened last time. We should not dare to repeat it.
Mm. So, Matt, respond to that, because I think Larry is very accurately reflecting the deep sense among some of Senator Sanders' most fervent supporters that regardless of who's in the White House now, it's America overall that needs to embrace big ideas. And that if what Vice President Joe Biden is offering is anything short of that, they don't know if he's the right person for them. And factually speaking, no matter who the Democratic nominee is come July, that person is going to need every single Democrat to show up to the polls in November. So how is that going to happen?
Well, I certainly agree with that. And I do agree with Larry that we should endeavor to have synthesis when we get to Milwaukee, and I hope that we will. And the place I think we can do that is on the ends, perhaps, rather than the means. All Democrats, certainly the two of us and everybody else agrees, that every American must have health care coverage. There is no question about that. Every Democrat believes that. And every Democrat believes that health care is way too expensive right now. We have to do something about it. The question of how can be wrestled over, I think, later. What we have to come together around is the proposition that we need to get everybody covered. We need to undo the horror of the Trump years when it comes to health care and every other policy, both domestic and foreign. And we have to make sure that democratic principles, which is that everyone should have health care and it should be affordable, are met.
Okay, but Matt, let me jump in here if I can. I mean,
yeah.
Isn't it safe to say that the question of how, which will come later, point taken, but in terms of what the goal is, Democrats already share that opinion. I don't know if I've heard from a single Democrat who doesn't think that every American should have access to great health care. I mean, there's already
sure.
agreement there. The problem
there
is the how.
Indeed. And we are in the middle of a tough election process where we're going to have to choose a leader who has a vision for how. And one of them will win and one of them will lose. And I'm not sure in the Rules Committee in Milwaukee we're going to be able to figure out how to bridge the difference between a $33 trillion Medicare for All plan and an extension of the ACA that covers everybody and lowers cost, which will also, incidentally, be pretty expensive. And I take Larry's point. We already do spend a lot of government money, but nothing like what Sanders proposes to spend. So actually getting to the precise policy ideas and harmonizing them, I just don't think is possible when the differences between Sanders and Biden are this enormous.
Okay. So, Larry, do you agree with that or disagree?
Well, I disagree a lot on the health care because, again, I think we're counting the same numbers twice. Two-thirds of current spending on health care is government. Another $600 billion is the total waste of private insurance compared to the administrative cost of Medicare, Medicaid, VA. That alone is $500 billion, $250 billion that Matt's counting there. This is annually, not the 10-year number that he keeps using. But $250 billion is the waste on pharmaceutical. We pay twice what the VA pays. We pay twice what every other country in the world pays. We add in a 10% payroll tax, new payroll tax, on employers, which cuts the cost of health care in half for every employer that provides it now, and we have closed the gap. We, in fact, will have health care at a cheaper price.
That just is
we are
not
at 17%.
True.
Hold on. We are at 17% of GDP, as Matt knows. Every other country is under 10. Where does the waste come from when we have worse outcomes on mortality and everything else that we can measure? So when we talk about synthesis, it's going to need to be, obviously we can't do it on a radio program, but it's going to be sitting down and looking at the real numbers and getting rid of some of this rhetoric, which is just meant to scare people and convince them that it's fine that you're spending on average $10,000 a year now on health care. That's what we're doing to people. And it's also totally, totally wrong to say to people, we'll have Medicare for those who want it. How much is that going to cost? That's on top of the existing health care bill. There's no savings in that plan.
Matt, I'll let you respond, and then I want to go to the calls. So go ahead, Matt.
I don't know that we want to dive too much deeper into this policy debate. You've heard a lot about it on the debate stages itself. The numbers Larry's citing just aren't right. And Senator Sanders himself has refused to say how much his bill cost. To her credit, Senator Warren tried to price it out. Not sure I agree with precisely her numbers, but at least she offered something. In fact, Senator Sanders said on television about 2 weeks ago that no one knows how much his plans will cost, including Medicare for All. That's really not a way forward for our party if we want to take on Trump.
All right, let's go to the callers quickly. Let's go to Ray, who's calling from Limerick, Maine. Ray, you're on the air.
Hey, how we all doing? I agree with the Bernie supporter guy. There's going to have to be some type of a coming together because if it just ends up being like what happened last time with Hillary taking everything and going her own way, then Trump will win.
So did you vote yesterday, Ray?
Yeah, I did.
And who'd you vote for?
I voted for Bernie.
Okay, so supporter of Senator Sanders there. If perchance the senator does not become the nominee, will you vote for whoever the Democratic nominee is in November?
Yes, but Biden is going to have to capitulate to the Bernie people to some degree, or else they'll simply stand down, or a good portion of them, and then he'll lose. So if he's serious, I mean, if he were truly serious, he would make Bernie his VP.
Interesting idea. Ray, thank you so much, for that call. Let's go quickly to Jim, who's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello, Magda. How are you?
I'm doing well. Go ahead.
That last caller actually frightens me. But anyway,
Why does he frighten you?
Well, I mean, he says that Biden will have to capitulate to the Sanders supporters. Quite frankly, Magna, and this is not my main point, but I don't think Democrats really care about policies and programs. They care about getting Donald Trump out of the White House, and they feel that Biden is the guy to do it. You look at last night's results. Look at the states that Biden won. Virginia, North Carolina, Minnesota, Texas. Key battleground states, states that Democrats will need in November. You look at the states that Sanders won. Obvious blue states. Obvious blue states.
You're thinking California, right?
Yes, yes. And he won Nevada and Colorado. I mean, these are blue states. I mean, Biden won the states that Democrats need in November. To me, that signals that the Democrats want Donald Trump out and they feel that Biden is the man to do it.
Well, Jim, I'm going to take it back from you there because I'm headed towards a break. But thank you so much for that call. Larry Cohen. I mean, I think, again, this is the question we're going to come up against over and over again. You heard the first caller there asking for the vision that Senator Sanders represents. But then Jim saying, well, actually, right now, the most important urgent vision for Democrats is to beat Donald Trump in November. Again, this is one of those fundamental divides. But let me ask you, what would you say to Jim to convince him that it is Senator Sanders who might be able to do that in the general?
Well, I would say two things. That first of all, the general is going to come down to, in all likelihood, Philadelphia County, Wayne County, which is Detroit, Milwaukee County, those three states. And we need bigger turnout, as Bernie said. The question is, what is the vision that gets a bigger turnout than in 2016 when Secretary Clinton won an overwhelming popular vote but lost those electoral votes? And that's why I say it's a synthesis of ideas and programs, not harsh rhetoric that will divide us.
All right. Well, we are talking about the path forward now for Democrats following yesterday's voting in Super Tuesday. When we come back, we'll talk about what's next for Senator Elizabeth Warren. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about what the path is ahead now for Democrats following the voting in 14 states yesterday in Super Tuesday. I'm joined today by Matt Bennett. He's co-founder of Third Way, a Washington think tank that promotes center-left policy. He worked on both of Bill Clinton's presidential campaigns. Larry Cohen also joins us as well. He's board chair for Our Revolution, a progressive political action organization that spun out of Senator Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. And on that same campaign, Larry served as an advisor to Senator Sanders. Now, today, following a terrible showing in Super Tuesday voting, Mike Bloomberg has dropped out of the race, and he's endorsing former Vice President Joe Biden. Bloomberg says, quote, "I've had the chance to work with Joe on those issues over the years, and Joe has fought for working people his whole life. Today, I'm glad to endorse him, and I will work to make him the next president of the United States." Now, Michael Bloomberg spent more than $500 million of his own money in just 100 days on his own campaign. So one wonders where that wealth or how that wealth could be applied as the race wears on. So that means that Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts still remains in the race. She picked up only 10 delegates yesterday. So here she is in Detroit last night giving this advice to Michigan voters who will cast their votes in a week.
So here's my advice. Cast a vote that will make you proud. Cast a vote from your heart. And vote for the person you think will make the best president of the United States of America.
Senator Elizabeth Warren in Michigan last night. And joining us now from Detroit is Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 political correspondent. Anthony, good to talk to you.
Hi, Meghna.
So you were following Senator Warren yesterday. What's the mood in her campaign? What's her mood right now?
Well, I mean, she is back in Massachusetts now, but clearly Super Tuesday was just so far from what Warren needed and what her campaign was looking to do. You heard her there speaking last night to voters. She had a great turnout. Over 2,000 people turned out. And that's sort of the interesting thing about Warren. She still has this core of very dedicated supporters and a message that they want to hear. But Meghna, she has, you know, if she has a path forward, she has to show that she can win. And she has not been able to do that. And what happened yesterday, on top of everything, on top of picking up only a handful of delegates and not doing better than third or fourth in a whole string of states, and not doing well in New Hampshire, not doing well in South Carolina, Nevada, on and on. She lost her home state of Massachusetts. She came in third. You know, this is really, really hard. And I woke up this morning thinking that her campaign has to be thinking about, you know, this narrowing path forward, right, and how she can go forward.
So
at this
Anthony,
point,
can I just
understand,
ask you? I'm sorry to interrupt, but can I just ask you a quick question? Because your long experience in this, I really want to mine it for as much as possible. Because about Senator Warren's poor showing in her home state of Massachusetts, well behind Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, I. You know, there was a lot of commentary last night saying that every Massachusetts Democrat who's run for president has always won Massachusetts in the primaries. But I just wonder if 2020 is such a different cycle, that what we're seeing now is exactly what we were hearing before in our conversation with Matt and Larry, who I'll come back to in a minute, that it's a question of this division between great vision and beating Donald Trump. And just at this moment in the election, even Massachusetts voters don't see Elizabeth Warren as answering either of those two calls.
No, I think that's really, really true. I mean, what's been fascinating to me about covering Warren, I mean, I've covered a bunch of these candidates, but I've spent more time with Warren than anybody else, is again and again and again and again. I heard this in Iowa. I heard it across New Hampshire. I even heard it last night in Michigan. You hear this passion, this, like, in my heart, you know, this is the person who I believe in. But people are tying themselves in knots with this difficult calculation about, but who can beat Donald Trump? And I think even in Massachusetts, you know, that came back to Joe Biden. CNN exit polling last night showed that a lot of people in Massachusetts made up their minds just in the last few days. And those late decisions broke, obviously, dramatically for Joe Biden. Meghna, you know about our poll. WBUR did a poll just last week, and the Massachusetts race was between Sanders and Warren. Biden wasn't even a factor. Mm-hmm. And suddenly he wins in South Carolina. And it's like this existential angst that has been haunting Democrats suddenly sort of allowed itself to express itself with, finally, we can back someone who we think, who our brains tell us has the best chance against Trump, even though our hearts are telling us that we would probably vote in another direction. And that's what Warren was trying to express last night in Michigan to those voters. Vote your heart. But a lot of people voted for Biden because they believe he's the guy who can best beat Donald Trump.
Well, Anthony, let's just go to a quick caller here on this point. Let's go to Susan, who's calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi. I think the media should take more responsibility for how they're steering voters away from certain candidates and towards certain candidates. Like, oh, somebody's winning. They've got momentum and somebody's not winning. So it gives people, it steers them toward certain candidates and away from others. It's kind of they're doing a horse race like they always admit to, instead of telling us what the candidates are going to do. And I think Warren wants to address corruption most of all. And what's extreme about that? She wants to make it work for everybody. Mm-hmm. She knows how to do it. She's done her homework. She's done her numbers. She has the vision of Sanders, but his only idea is a revolution. She knows how to do it. And Biden's idea is working with the Republicans. Well, that hasn't worked real well either. And I think the media is not giving her the credit that she deserves. She's quick on her feet. She can give as good as she gets. And Biden is going to give, he's already given us Clarence Thomas, the Iraq War, the bankruptcy bill, and Burisma. I don't understand,
Susan,
how he can possibly go.
Let me ask, if I can just ask a quick question, Susan, because I'm just always, there's no way to answer this, but I'm wondering what you think. I always wonder, would it be different if Elizabeth Warren were a man?
I think there's no question that sexism is alive and well in this country.
Yeah.
And I think the way they treated Hillary was abysmal, and they're doing the same thing to Warren, writing her off. Like, they criticized her forever because, oh, how are you going to pay for your health care plan? And she comes up with a very clever way, a very elegant way mm-hmm. of using the money that's already there. And then she's criticized because she's going to implement yeah. it in a more practical way. And then she's written off. And Bernie gets a free pass. He doesn't know how he's going to do it except by blustering.
Yeah. Well, Susan, thank you for much. I'm going to take it back from you there, but thank you so much for your call. Anthony, you want to quickly respond to Susan?
Yeah, I mean, I think Susan raises some great points. I mean, I do think there's a level of sexism that Warren has been contending with. I talked to a voter in Massachusetts last week who was supporting Warren, and he said to me, if Elizabeth Warren were a man, she'd be the front runner. She'd be so far out front, you couldn't see her. A lot of people feel that way, and I think there's some validity to those concerns. But what's interesting is I talked to a lot of women voters, and I found them in Iowa and I found them in New Hampshire, who said in their heart they would vote for Elizabeth Warren, but they didn't think their neighbors would.
Mm.
So I don't think this the gender issue that has blocked Warren to a certain extent only comes from male voters.
Right.
It's also coming from female voters.
Well, the self-fulfilling prophecy, as Susan was saying.
A little bit, yeah.
Look, so Anthony, as far as we understand, Senator Warren says she's still staying in the race. But it, like, her path forward seems so narrow as to be almost invisible. Ultimately, right. Could she still, though, be a factor in this race if she eventually comes to a point where she decides to drop out? If wouldn't her endorsement be extremely coveted by both Biden and Sanders?
Oh, I think it would. I think it would be. And it's sort of hard to imagine her. I mean, I'll just tell you what I think in my gut, and I may be completely wrong because this election season is just proving all the prognosticators and all of the predictions wrong again and again, and we keep learning that lesson, don't make predictions. But I would be really surprised if she endorsed Joe Biden. She's much closer in terms of the issues to Bernie Sanders, obviously. I mean, she represents the progressive wing. So it would seem to me that if she were to drop out, that's the direction she would go in. But she's also, you know, leveled a pretty strong criticism against Bernie Sanders. And that is, you know, show us a record. Give us a sense of what you've been actually able to get done. And, you know, she argues that that's in stark contrast to her record, where she's actually gotten stuff done and all of these detailed plans. And I think the caller made a great point. You know, she got hammered for her Medicare for All, how she's going to pay for it plan. And Bernie Sanders has never faced that kind of scrutiny. And he really hasn't explained in detail how he would pay for Medicare for All. So there's a lot going on here. But to come back to your original point, it's very unclear what her path forward is. And I'll just say this finally. I suspect that Elizabeth Warren is staying in it because she feels the loyalty of these dedicated followers. There are a lot of people, millions of folks who have given her a lot of money. She still has that money. And I think she feels a sense of obligation to them to carry this message forward as far as she can go.
Mm.
And I think that's what we're seeing today.
Well, Anthony Brooks, On Point's 2020 correspondent with us from Detroit today. Anthony, thank you so much.
My pleasure as always, Meghna.
Okay, so Larry Cohen and Matt Bennett, thank you for your patience there. But let's talk a little bit about how Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders might seek to woo Elizabeth Warren's voters depending on how long the senator continues to want to stay in the race. I mean, Matt, you just heard Anthony say that it's likely that Elizabeth Warren's voters may trend more towards Senator Sanders. What do you think about that?
I think we have to be very careful about characterizing a large group of voters in any particular way, particularly in this very chaotic election cycle that we're in. Obviously, Elizabeth Warren is always paired with Sanders in the so-called liberal lane. And to be sure, she is proposing some things that are very similar to his. I mean, one of the seminal moments of this election was when she said, "I'm with Bernie on this," when it came to Medicare for All. But that is not the same as her voters all being kind of dyed-in-the-wool revolutionary-type liberals. I think that a lot of people are going to be surprised about where her voters go if, in fact, she does drop out of this race. I think you could see a very significant percentage, maybe the majority of them, moving to Biden because their view is the thing that matters most is beating Trump. We will sort out the details on the means and ends later, and Biden seems more likely to do so.
Larry, what's your thought on that?
Well, my thought is that, first of all, Elizabeth's a great candidate. I was able to work with her a lot when I was president of the Communication Workers Union. I think it's totally up to her what she does. I would say that clearly, overwhelmingly, there's a correspondence between her voters and Bernie's. But, I've always believed that it's about A plus B, not A versus B. And again, that's my view of this whole election. I can't help but add in these closing minutes, we should stop using revolutionary as a pejorative when, in fact, everybody knows we're talking about political revolution, when everybody knows that candidates like Bloomberg are abhorrent, that he can come in and buy his way in to an election like this, that money in politics is revolting, and that we have horrible voting rights records across the country. We're talking about a political revolution. We're not talking about revolution in any kind of negative way. We need a revolution in terms of how we approach the same ideas, like healthcare, like climate change, that every other democracy, voting rights, every other democracy in the world is now way ahead of us. We need to get ourselves situated and then figure out how we move forward.
Right. You know, to the point about buying one's way into American politics, point taken. But on the other hand, Mike Bloomberg spent $5 million a day roughly for 100 days and it got him nothing. So maybe individual voters are pushing back against that here at the polls in the primary season. But I just want to circle back to one thing about the seeming natural overlap between Warren voters and Biden and Sanders voters. I mean, Massachusetts is still an interesting test case on this because her home state, it's Joe Biden who won here. 33% of primary voters yesterday in Massachusetts voted for Biden, whereas only 26% of them voted for Sanders. So, again, there's that question of maybe the overriding sentiment in many people's minds is who can beat Donald Trump in November. But listen, we have 2 minutes left, and there's one final question I want to quickly ask of both of you, because I think we've heard it shot through this hour today. For as long as there are such significant differences, and we're not just talking about in style, we're talking about in actual policies and vision amongst the Democrats, as if there are these fractures, is every day that that persists a day that simply further strengthens President Trump in November? Matt, what do you think about that?
No. I think that voters expect us to have real debates and real fights for nominations and then come back together and take on Trump together in the summer and fall. But the spring is a time for choosing who is going to lead us. And I don't think a respectful debate between these two candidates is a problem for Democrats, as long as we are all resolved that we will work as hard as we can to bridge the gaps, as Larry was talking about earlier. And that whatever happens, we have to get rid of Trump. That is the overwhelming political imperative of our time.
Well, respectful debate, yes, but I'm hearing both of you saying that there ultimately needs to be a synthesis of ideas here. Can that synthesis begin before July, Larry?
Yeah, I think some of it is the tone in, the March 15th debate, for example. And I agree with Matt, the way we campaign brings these differences out. But I think for lots of us, people like me and Matt and, large groups like Our Revolution, we have to be pointing at what a synthesis means. It's not a repeat of 2016. It means you take a blend of ideas. You share power in terms of who is leading the government, not just the vice president, but the key positions. And I think that kind of power sharing is what we need to create the enthusiasm that we will need, not only to beat Donald Trump, but to bring our country into a 21st century democracy that we all want to see.
Well, Larry Cohen is board chair for Our Revolution, a progressive political action organization that spun out of Senator Sanders' 2016 presidential campaign. He's also vice chair of the Democratic National Committee's Unity Reform Commission. Larry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
And Matt Bennett, co-founder of Third Way, a Washington think tank promoting center-left political or policy ideas. He worked on both of Bill Clinton's presidential campaigns and served as deputy assistant to the president for intergovernmental affairs in the Clinton White House as well. Matt Bennett, thank you.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.